Sciences Program. I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:40 in sports this afternoon. Top-ranked Anna Ivanovic is among the first-round winners at the U.S. Open today. She trailed 3-2 in the third set before pulling out a 6-1, 4-6, 6-4 victory. Indianapolis Colts quarterback Peyton Manning is able to practice again after being activated earlier in the day. Manning had been on the physically unable to perform list since the opening of training camp following surgery to remove an infected bursa sac from his left knee on July 14th. Manning was expected to go through team drills for the first time this afternoon. Jets coach Eric Mangini says he's leaning toward not playing quarterback Brett Favre in the team's preseason finale at Philadelphia. Favre has repeatedly said he wants to play Thursday night, but also has said that he wouldn't be too disappointed if the coach decided otherwise. Favre went 9 of 12 for 96 yards in the Jets' 10-7 win over the Giants last Saturday. The White Sox continue their three-game series against the Baltimore Orioles in Maryland tonight. Gavin Floyd will take the mound for Chicago. He's 13-6 this season. The St. Louis Cardinals and the Milwaukee Brewers play the first of two games at Busch Stadium tonight. Milwaukee has won 4 straight and 14 of its last 18, while St. Louis has stayed within striking distance in the wild card race by winning 7 of its last 10. The Brewers hold a 3.5-game lead over St. Louis. And pitcher Carlos Zambrano will try to help the first-place Chicago Cubs earn a 4th straight victory and continue their dominance over the struggling Pittsburgh Pirates tonight. Zambrano is 13-5 with a 3.29 ERA this season. Pirates starter Ian Snell is 5-10. That's sports.
NPR will be at the Democratic and Republican National Conventions, bringing you the key speeches of the day, interviews with those making the news, and analysis from their election team. Get the best in convention coverage from the presidential candidates to the parties and protests. Andrea Seabrook hosts special nightly convention coverage from NPR News tonight from 7 to 10 p.m. here on AM 580.
The national headlines about the opening of the Democratic National Convention belong to celebrities like Ted Kennedy and Michelle Obama. But as Amanda Winicky reports, Illinois Democrats who share a history with Barack Obama received onstage billing at the convention as well.
It was 4 years ago when Barack Obama gave the keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. It launched him toward this convention, where he'll officially be named his party's presidential nominee. Last night, Obama's Illinois friends and colleagues took the stage to help make Obama more real to delegates and the audience beyond Denver's Pepsi Center. First up,
please welcome Illinois State Senator Emil Jones, Jr.
Jones made his remarks before primetime TV coverage, but already thousands of delegates, guests, elected officials, and reporters were packed into the convention center, as Jones told of meeting Obama.
I was a state senator on the south side of the city of Chicago, where I met a handful of people on a street corner planning what to do about the high school dropout rate. They were led by this skinny kid, Barack Obama.
Other Illinois officials followed, telling their stories of working with Obama. Comptroller Dan Hines was among them, and here, State Treasurer Lexi Janulius.
Now, I've known Barack for over 10 years, and I have never met anyone with more strength of character and integrity. Barack is one of the kindest and most genuinely decent people in the world.
Janulius blew through his allotted 2 minutes, but watching from the convention floor in front of the stage, his mother, Anna Janulius, didn't care.
My heart is bumping. It's getting ready to burst.
The treasurer's mom had one of the best seats in the house. Front row seats are a perk of being from the presumptive candidate's home state. And also down in front, House Speaker Mike Madigan. His daughter, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, spoke of serving with Obama in the state Senate.
When I became an Illinois state senator, I was one of only 5 Democratic women. So I didn't expect to find many strong allies in the fight for women and children. But as it turned out, I found a passionate ally sitting at the desk right next to me, Barack Obama.
Former State Senator Miguel Del Valle, now Chicago's city clerk, also spoke of that time.
He fought to bring quality, affordable health care to more Illinois residents and to make sure that prescription drugs were priced fairly. He led the successful effort to rein in the lobbyists in our state.
His comments seemed calculated to blunt criticisms that Obama's inexperienced and has a weak legislative record. Congressman Jesse Jackson says in 2004, when Obama decided to run for the U.S. Senate, many Illinois power brokers had similar doubts.
Most in Springfield didn't take his candidacy all that seriously. The party establishment was skeptical of this young leader from the South Side.
The speeches by Jackson and the other Illinois delegates didn't electrify the crowd, but at least one delegate, Alta Beasley of Ohio, said they made Obama seem more real.
I learned that what we've been hearing is accurate, and it, you know, that's how who he is. So there was a confirmation of Barack Obama.
Beasley says stories of Obama's early days in Illinois from those who were there added a personal touch. That's likely just what the Obama campaign had been trying for. At the Democratic National Convention in Denver, I'm Amanda Vinicky.
And this story has everything to do with who is carrying the baton now for the Democrats. Senator Hillary Clinton's supporters are planning a march in Denver for women's rights, and there are questions about whether her most loyal supporters will get behind Barack Obama. NPR's Debbie Elliott spoke with two who are wrestling with that question.
Hillary Clinton delegates are a tight-knit set. Many of them know each other from working on the campaign. That was the case for the two women I sat down with in a downtown Denver hotel to talk about their expectations for this convention.
I'm Alita Black. I live in Arlington, Virginia. I went to 14 states. I knocked on about 5,000 doors, made about 15,000 phone calls, and I did about 100 house parties. I'm an academic. I cashed in retirement to pay for it. I didn't sleep for 18 months.
I'm Mary Borgers. I live in Chevy Chase, Maryland. I was coordinator for the Hillary Clinton campaign in Montgomery County. I was not looking forward to coming here.
Borgers and Black are whips for the Clinton campaign on the convention floor, and both are active in the petition drive to put Clinton's name into nomination for a roll call vote Wednesday.
If the Obama campaign fails to have a true roll call vote, where the pledged delegates get to vote for the candidate that they were selected and elected to represent, I think people will come out of the convention ununified. And so the ball is really in the Obama campaign's court.
They're frustrated when they hear it's time for Clinton to release her delegates and help unify the party. Borgers says Obama will have to close the deal by acknowledging Clinton and her supporters.
While we didn't make it all the way to the finish line, that we have an opportunity to celebrate. It's almost like the silver medal at an Olympics. And if we're denied that, and it's just a charade and a pretense, the Obama campaign is going to be in trouble because people are going to leave here angry. And a lot of them are going to leave here thinking, once again, it's just because Hillary's a woman.
As for Clinton's speech tonight, Alita Black says she's ready.
I'm going to scream my lungs out for her on the floor. I'm going to get everybody around me to scream their lungs out on the floor. I'm going to dance. I'm going to wear my infamous orange sneakers. I'm going to hand out Hillary signs until I'm on my knees begging people to carry them. And then I'm going to listen to Hillary, and Hillary's going to take us to the next level.
After Wednesday, Black says she hopes to be able to don an Obama-Biden T-shirt.
Right now, I want to vote for him, but I'm not there yet. And I know that if she hears this, she's going to give me a really, really, really hard time.
Borgers isn't so sure.
I'm a Democrat. I have never voted for a Republican for president. I don't know what I'll do. I have never felt this way before.
It's a bittersweet moment, she says, to be standing up for Hillary Clinton at the Democratic National Convention. But on the convention floor last night, other Clinton delegates appeared ready to move on. 79-year-old Angie Galaretto of Pennsylvania.
as a Democratic ward leader, I knew that my position was to support the candidate that was chosen, and that was Obama. And I have no regrets. I intend to go out and work very hard for him.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Denver.
WILL programming is made possible by Tires Plus Total Car Care, located at Prospect and Market View in Champaign. Tires Plus provides complete car repair and maintenance. More information is available at 366-3201.
It's 10 minutes before 3 o'clock. The arrest of a library clerk in Alamance County, North Carolina, highlights two competing values. One is to enforce immigration laws. The other is to provide health care to those who need it. The 23-year-old was picked up after seeking medical care. The case raises fears that officials may be using health records to find and deport illegal immigrants. North Carolina Public Radio's Jessica Jones reports.
It's a hot summer night, and dozens of people have formed a circle outside the Alamance County Commission office.
Come join us. Let's get close enough so that we can hear each other.
Elon University's chaplain, Richard McBride, leads the group. One by one, they step to the center to speak, including Irene Godinez.
I'm thinking of my family who had to escape Mexico because there was no opportunity for prosperity and are now afraid to leave their house.
The group organized the vigil to protest the arrest of Marjavi Angel Martinez. She came to the U.S. from Mexico legally as a toddler with her parents, but they broke the law when they overstayed their visas. Jose Alegria is a Latino advocate in the county. He says immigration agents arrested Martinez at her job at the library.
In fact, she received medical care during her pregnancy. That is a fact. It is a fact that she was using someone else's social security number. Yes.
Martinez pleaded guilty to misuse of a social security number and is now in deportation proceedings. She wants to stay in the United States and will fight the charges. Her arrest came after some county leaders called for an investigation of the health department. They said illegal immigrants were draining the department's resources.
What is rare here is to then have information used to deport someone.
Pam Dixon is the executive director of the World Privacy Forum, a nonprofit group that researches privacy issues. She says it is legal for law enforcement officials to request health records as part of a healthcare investigation. But Dixon says using those records to make an arrest outside that realm is scary.
What you don't want to have is a system in which someone goes to a public health clinic and then that is used as a treasure trove of subpoena land. You do not want that.
Local officials won't say whether Martinez's health records led to her arrest, but a federal program called 287G allows local authorities to begin the deportation process. At a recent county commissioners meeting, Sheriff Terry Johnson told a crowded room he won't turn his back on violations of the law like identity theft.
And folks, I'm going to tell you something. I will not do it. I have not done it, and I'm not going to do it. If you want to come here illegally and live in this country, do not violate any laws.
After the meeting, Alamance County Health Director Barry Bass said he hasn't seen a decrease in patient visits, but he wouldn't say whether the move has discouraged immigrants to seek health care.
Everybody has to make a decision for themselves if they're comfortable receiving service.
What's happening in Alamance County worries doctors. Peter Morris is the medical director of one of North Carolina's largest network of clinics in Raleigh. He says if someone has an infectious disease and is scared to see a doctor, that affects everyone in the community.
If people come to our offices afraid that if they tell us something, that that information could be used against them, I think it will chill the relationship in the doctor's office, and that's something we all should fear.
Since charges were filed against Marjavi Angel Martinez, immigration authorities have also arrested her parents and her husband. They're facing deportation, too. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Jones in Durham, North Carolina.
It's 2:54. When someone is injured, that person's loved ones can sometimes sue for damages done to them personally. Commentator Amy Guida says this loss of consortium is an idea that's been around a long time and that's seen a lot of changes.
There's a concept in personal injury law known as loss of consortium. It gives a legal remedy to the spouse of someone who's been seriously injured by a third party. Loss of Consortium recognizes that accidents sometimes affect not only direct victims, but also their loved ones. And it's meant to compensate those loved ones for the loss of the companionship, love, and services of the injured spouse. Loss of Consortium started way back when women were basically considered the property of their husbands. Just like a husband could sue the person who injured his best mule, he could also sue the person who injured his wife. In a somewhat more pleasant analogy, as one court put it, the action was similar to that of a master for enticement of his servant. But times change. Eventually, women got the legal right to be treated as separate entities, not simply pieces of property. And even though husbands maintained their rights to sue for the loss of companionship of wives, wives also got the right to sue for loss of consortium of their husbands. Now, spouses of both genders may sue for loss of consortium, loss of companionship, when the other spouse is injured due to the defendant's actions. Note that I've used those words carefully, husband and wife and spouse. That's because in a majority of states, and Illinois is more expansive but fact-specific, so anyone interested should contact their local attorney, the action is limited to husbands and wives and spouses, not children, not anybody else, even a very close relative or friend. But times change. I add the word spouse to include same-sex couples. Those who marry in Massachusetts or California, or who join in a civil union in states that recognize that proceeding, are recognized as a couple under the law, and either person in the union can receive loss of consortium damages if an accident injures his or her spouse. But not if that person is simply a significant other, no matter how long they've been together, not even in a state as accepting of same-sex relationships as Massachusetts. That became obvious just last month when Massachusetts' highest court decided a case involving a same-sex married couple. Trouble was that they weren't married at the time of the injury to one of the women. Sure, they'd been dating monogamously for 12 years before the injury, had gone through a private ceremony with exchange of rings, and even adopted a child together. They'd been married as soon as it became legal in Massachusetts, and said that they would have been married at the time of the injury if only the law had allowed it. Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, who just 5 years earlier had written the court opinion authorizing same-sex couples to marry, expressed sympathy for their predicament, but she also emphasized the need for a bright line between civil marriage and other forms of relationships. The law would stick with the traditional rule limiting loss of consortium claims to marriage. When it comes to injured loved ones, it seems, even Massachusetts is the traditionalist. The times today, they remain the same. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gunn Foundation, and the Americana Foundation. Send your thoughts and ideas to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Earth and sky.
We're just at the beginning of something that's going to be very big. And I think if we look at our food supply in 10 or 20 years, we're going to be surprised at how much change has come about.
That's Michael Pollan, best known for his book, The Omnivore.